Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. I'm delighted to introduce you to Haider Alag, a strategist, entrepreneur, and an investor helping regulated industries scale through innovation and brand performance. As a founder of Kindju, marketing and strategy consultancy for regulated industries, and GP at Allegory Capital, Haider can bring us some really interesting perspectives of what it takes to innovate in sectors that are notoriously hard to innovate in. Haider, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, listen, we've been having a lot of great chats as partners in figuring out how do we bring innovation, particularly digital and experiential innovation, to regulated world. This is a world that has a harder bar to innovate. And, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on what inspired you to start, you know, and focus Kindju on these industries.
I mean, there is a, so it's a, thanks for having me again. And it's a good question because it's not the easiest industries to be in. And when I say regulated industry, I think we need to put a bit of definition in there. The world is getting more regulated while we hear that the US might want to deregulate quite a bit some stuff. But still, the world is becoming more regulated. We've seen that with data privacy, you know, and different programs in the EU recently. So for me, regulated means that we have high bars to entry, like you said. Like there is a code of conduct, there is some rules that you need to comply to penetrate the market, which protects the market in a way from misconduct. And I will, for the audience that is listening to you, I will say, if you want to sell honeybee online, that you might have less regulation than if you want to sell an OTC drugs, you know, on a pharmacy shop, right? So that's kind of is where we said to ourselves 20 years ago when I started myself in this industry. I said to myself, oh, there is some complexity here. And being an engineer as a background, I said, yeah, I can find you know, some solution for that complexity. So that's how it started.
And what is the particular challenge that you see in, you know, communicating creatively in this world? Like what would you say is super relevant from your point of view?
So I would say if I look at the pharma industry, which I know a little bit better than the others, in the pharma world, creativity has been outsourced to creative agency. You know, like if I put it bluntly, it's like, oh, we need to be creative. Let's hire Publicis, Havas, DDB, Dentsu, you know, that those folks. Mm-hmm. And so creativity has never been in terms of creating a delightful experience for the patient or for the doctor. It was like, let's do the best drug ever, the best science ever. And if we do that, somehow the doctor will prescribe. Yeah. So we don't need to, right? Because the system will just use us. And right now, what is the pressure on those industry players is the doctor and the patient is a consumer of other experiences. So they have a higher expectation in terms of the app they will use, the website they will consume, the PDF even they will download. So you don't have any more.
Or pretend to download.
Or pretend to download. But you don't have any more this kind of excuse that, oh, yeah, it's crap. I can basically just deal with it. It's just healthcare, right? So I will say
So
to your
basically, in
audience,
the old world, the bar for healthcare was low because it was said, hey, we're healthcare, we're different, we're scientists, and the best drug wins.
yeah, exactly. And it's kind of, there is like, it's a generational thing. Look at your parents or my parents. They were kind of excusing three types of category of work, right? The banker, yeah, I don't ask my banker to create me a delightful experience. I just want the banker to make my money work. My lawyer, I don't want to have a delightful experience with my legal counsel. I just want him to fight and win, right? And my doctor, I just want him to fix myself. I don't want to have a delightful experience. Well, our generation and the new generation is a little bit more demanding in terms of the time that you are requesting them to compute to actually deal with information or data. So, because the world is much more digital and you're consuming much more data and services through those channels, the level of experience is not excusable anymore, right? And that's basically for
Interesting.
me where you have a little bit of a pressure point, I will say. So, if you're building a digital health platform, or if you're creating a communication plan for the clinical practice of like doctors. Now, those doctors, they have like 30 years old, 35, 40 maybe, and they will tell you, I'm not spending 10 minutes to create a login. That sucks. So they don't do it, right? So
So this sort of the old school enterprise software and the kind of era design, for lack of a better umbrella, what you're just describing, just simply no longer works. But it's not because these industries have changed dramatically. It's because the rest of the world has changed dramatically, and the consumers of regulated services are also, first and foremost, general consumers, whether they're employees, healthcare professionals, or patients, they're just spoiled by good, easy to understand content. And so the more regulated industries basically have to leapfrog what has been this de facto standard in their bubble, in order to be effective. And whoever does that leapfrogging the best will have an edge in that
Correct.
industry. Is
I mean,
that
look at the banking. So I love to use banking, the banking industry, the finance industry, the insurance industry as a benchmark. So they've been in the same place 20 years ago. So your e-banking experience was crap. No one wanted to spend time on an e-banking 20 years ago. And right now, if you look at Revolut or Stripe or N26, all those little banks. You want to send money to your friends? Yeah, easy. Yeah, just do it. There is no barriers. Of course, it's not free, right? There is always some hooks, associated with it. But it works. It's just making you focus your time on something else. And in the in what I will say where there are like huge pain points for the pharma industry, for example, is trying to catch up because there is trying to catch up and delegate things to Havas and having a black box. But I think there is the brands that are like doing a good job creating those delightful experience. It's also anchored into talent and culture, right? So people want to do it. They want to, they are obsessed by creating a perfect customer experience. Like if you look at Zalando, for example, or you look at I don't know, like Airbnb or there is attention to detail on looking at the data, understanding the data, and saying, okay, people are not using that form, let's change it. What I've witnessed in the industry is that we have to build, X, Y, and Z for making the year, checking the box, getting our bonuses. I did the campaign, delegated to an agency, checked the box, got my bonus, move on to the next brand. And there is not enough of that obsessive willingness to create delightful experiences. And that is not the fault of the brand leads or the communication leaders. I will ne never put the fault on them. It's just I would say it's a company structure and the systems creating their own creatures in a way. So don't blame the messenger in a way, right? They are just executing. Blame the culture of the company that is basically focusing on the wrong thing sometimes.
And so where's the disruption coming from? It feels like digital health companies are a lot more younger in and have a different DNA than some traditional companies. Sometimes they're competing for the same mind share, if not identical products. What would be your what is your view of what who are the best practice examples of who's doing something really amazing in these regulated, let's say pharma and digital health world that challenges everybody?
I mean, it's yeah, it's you see, it's an interesting question. If you ask me, and if you ask yourself, will you follow the Instagram of a pharma company to have an amazing experience, so much so that you will share it with your friends? The answer is probably no. So I really have a hard time giving you a name of a pharma company that is doing something nice. On the digital health side, there are some companies, like on the mental health side in the US and so on, that did some really nice campaigns that are moving, that are making people use also symptom checker like services to actually have a wake-up call. And the question from this digital health startup, when we see them, it's because they are small, they are faster, they don't have the luxury of time like some big pharma have. And also the world has changed. To create to host a webinar, you don't need a crew to host a webinar. You can do it yourself. So there is less question on, oh yeah, should we buy 10 mics to actually have a good sound? No, they just go with it with their iPhones. Do you want to do a cover for the webinar? Just go on Canva and do it. You see, so there is much more like willingness to hustle and say, yeah, let's just do the 80% good enough with a template. And that approach is actually working, most of the time. So, and even more so now with AI coming to facilitate, the onboarding. So I would say digital health startups or companies, the one that did a good job are first of all consumer facing, so they are
Right,
not
that's where I
necessarily.
was gonna go with it. So I'm thinking their DNA is just like if you're looking at something like Calm, which is now becoming a part of employee-sponsored health and benefits packages in the US, right? But obviously their origins were very much as a consumer company. That is about as diametrical of a DNA as you would expect compared to a traditional pharma that may still have some drugs that are helping with health mental health issues, right? Like, so for me, that is where the collision is the most prominent. And I think then there's some hybrid where that's a digital health solution that's still more traditional B2B and
I
has
mean,
to go through
it's
their
in the word, right?
trials.
So you have digital and health, right? You have some startup that are healthcare startup that went digital, and you have digital startup that are coming to the healthcare world, right? So there is like two forces. The companies that started to build something simple with a beautiful experience, very consumer-ish, they usually are looking for growth and volume. Have a critical mass, what we say, if you have 1 million user in your app, whatever is your app, you'll find the business model, right? You'll figure it out. And some of the startups that are like having this approach usually gets the complexity of the healthcare practice later. They start to say, oh, now out of the 1 million mental health potential patient we have, let's do an algorithm that detects burnout, or let's take depression, whatever. So this is a good approach actually. I prefer actually that approach that is creating the demand and educating the market, then the other part that is a little bit more scientific, which is more like let's take 300 patients in a hospital and let's build a just a simple questionnaire. Doesn't have to look good because the doctor will force it in the hands of the patient. And then suddenly, after 3 years, because those studies takes time, after 3 years, the startup is saying, "Hey, I have a validation of my questionnaire. Great, it's scientifically relevant," which is great for the science. But at the end of the day, as a business, you're looking at it and you say, "You have only 300 patients. What do we do with this, right? How do you scale? How do you get to 1 million?" And that is basically the burden that is on those startups. So yes, those startups have a different skill set, different culture. That's why I use the word culture. If you hire someone from, and I think, remember, Novartis tried to do that a couple of times. Sanofi tried to do that, to hire people from the perfume industry, from the tech industry. Even if you bring one leader inside the company to bring that, focus on creating delightful experiences, it's not enough. The company needs to basically understand the value, the long-term value of creating a better experience. And content, so we were saying content is king for many years, which is true. But right now we are talking about vertical videos, high velocity content, high velocity channel. When I hear like companies saying we need to post twice a day on Instagram as a pharma company, what are you saying? What is your strategy? What is it, what are you trying to convey? What's your goal? Posting two times a day on Instagram, you're not going to promote your product. You can't. It's forbidden. So what are you going to promote? So that is, I think, when you take content only just for posting without having like the soul of the
The
company within
soul,
it.
so basically, so you're, it's kind of a little bit, you so the use the perfume example. So there's this, obviously, the phrase like, lipstick on a pig, but this is like a pig that has lipstick and perfume, but you kind of still at the end of the day realize it still thinks in a relatively traditional, old school way. And so I guess if we take a step back, what would it take to change to really put excellence in content in a way that is more modern, right? Like that is, let's say there's a culture change, and then there's like some business objectives that are that in your view are best in class. Describe to me that platonic ideal of a still regulated DNA of a kind of major company. But it's really turning itself, has a brand new CMO, has a switched on CEO, and they have the mandate to change the way they think about content as a king, queen, and the fuel for all good things in the company and outside. What would that look like? Like, describe to me your ideal scenario of the future.
Yeah, I think if you're looking at those industries and looking at what good looks like, like put a definition of what good looks like. I would say right now authenticity is going to be the new currency for so that's the first piece, because the more and more you will create content with templates, they are going to feel a little bit deja vu by book, like a lot of people, for a lot of reason. That's okay. I'll give you an example, because context is going to be more powerful than the authenticity. So I believe more than if you're trying to find an information about a drug, like the SMPCs, the summary of product characteristic, you need to know if you can give that drug to your kid or not. You don't
You don't
really
need to be
care.
creative, right? Like there's
No.
no, there's
So
a,
context is always more powerful. And I think in some of those critical moments, when the brand needs to be the first answer, you want to have that kind of service approach, like I'm the best in the standard of giving the right content to the right person at the right time. I have the right piece of info. So I think the contextualization of the information, the way it is structured, and the way it is presented, the simplicity of it, I think that will be much more appreciated. Like if you're driving in south of Italy for vacation, you have your tire broken, you need to find a solution. If I drive a Volvo, if Volvo did a good job, maybe I will use my Volvo app. And if they did something nice, I'm not going to Google or anything else. I'm just going to use the brand that created me the fastest time to context solution. Now, that said, that is one behavior, right? People having a problem acting to it. And then you have people that are a little bit more into a research mode, right? Or a entertainment mode. And this is, I think, where the world of social media and even the news world, right? The journalist, the investigative journalist, right? If you took a t take content, investigative journalists that are covering war, that is a high context type of content, right? And right now, the news outlet are a little bit more entertaining, right? With a bit of like contextual news, but you want to entertain the user. You want to create that dopamine rush. You want to create that hormone that social media has been proven to hook you up with. So I think in that context, it's becoming much more complicated for those industries to compete because the time available to capture the showstopper, the creativity to do that is much harder. And I will say here, in a world where all brands are going to rush with templates, authenticity is a new window of opportunity to actually feel genuine. So if I have a brand, if I am talking to the CMO of a new brand, I will actually tell him, don't try to go to the rat race of posting twice a day on Instagram just to please the algorithm. What happens when it comes to six times a day, right? You're going to be the victim of an algorithm. And you're just going to rush. Maybe focus on authenticity
So
and
basically,
really.
getting a story that really like sticks and authentic and kind of stick, like you still need coverage distribution for that story,
Yes. Yeah,
but it's
that's
not
a.
it's less about the formula as much as it is about like getting authentically narrative of like why this story matters and why it interrupts.
Correct. Yeah, I would say if you have a budget of 10K, you know, just to keep it simple, and you have to divide it into mini posts, you know, to create whatever, I would say, you know, hire a team that is going to take a good like the make the people talk, right? Like the people who are creating this vision, make them talk instead of taking a template and just making this mechanical update. So again, mechanical update when it is contextual, okay, fair enough.
It's a necessity, right? Like, I think that's
Yeah.
kind of back to traditional content excellence.
Correct. I'll give you an example for pharma conferences. Pharma loves to do symposiums, right? Scientific symposiums. And usually when pharma is looking into communication plans around the scientific event, my recommendation is always, okay, you know, like you have to tease, you know, before the event, you know, the speakers, you know, the who created the symposium, the advisory board, blah, 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 right? It's a content-driven kind of teaser so that people can choose to spend time there instead of the competition. And in that case, I would actually give a little capsule of 1 minute of each member of that advisory board on the why they should actually come instead of just an agenda that is super cold. Imagine the experience, right? You don't have time to read, so you just have like you swipe and you have eight figures that are like opinion leaders telling you the why they spend time building that agenda. Then during the event or one day before the event, you give those logistical news. Where to find the symposium? When is it? Do you need to reserve? Do you need to click somewhere? Do you need to have like an option to have a lunch bag? You know, all those logistic things that are what I call contextual content that are needed that you don't need to put like so
You
much
don't need to.
creativity on it. Yeah.
So it feels like because of the history of the industry and the training and just the nature of the mind share, it's like it's a very clinical, detail-oriented, evidence-driven approach. And so whenever you say evidence, you have to put everything, right? You have to have an abstract, you have to have the body, the conclusion. Like, so the mindset of sharing lots of content is prevalent. And I think it's what you're saying is it's splitting into areas where it's not as relevant, right? In the sort of high level marketing. And so it kind of you overwhelm people with details.
And the expense is going to be more on the type of channels. So the pressure on this type of industry is more on the type of channel. If you ask someone to download another app, you're going to have a huge burden to convert. If you ask someone, I'll give you an example. If you say, okay, download my app, but basically you're going to have for free a resume from my scientific team of the whole papers that are going out. You're not selling an app anymore. You're selling a service of basically a peer-reviewed, meta-analysis of the entire events. And then those doctors who need to come back and they don't have time to read, they say, oh, of course I'm going to download that app because I have free Wi-Fi embedded, like everything is going to be a neat experience. So these type of ideas, it's like when content and services are bundled to create the experience. But you said something interesting. You said like this industry is having a lot of content. Yes, but that's for me is never been the like a blocker. Those guys are usually used to consume, lots of heavy scientific paper. What is problematic is the conduit. So if you look at a doctor, they don't want to talk about a drug necessarily. So again, if they have a problem with a patient, a severe symptoms, and they want to have kind of recommendations on what others do in that area, they don't want to Google and find like 20
Random
information,
stuff. Yeah.
right? So they want to go to the one-stop shop where they say, okay, there was a study on 20 people there with this type of symptoms. That's the next best decision to act. Should I double the dose? Should I do another protocol? Who is testing things here? Can I contact another doctor who had? So
Yeah.
you see my point. So the problem has never been when they are in the work trying to find the information and the data. It was more like, okay, I need to go further the content and I need to explore. And the problem we had, it was like, hey, click on 20 disclaimers before you get to the scientific liaison. And before you get to the scientific liaison who can answer your question, did you know that we have another label for the drug? Blah, blah, blah. Right? You push so much promotional info that the doctor is like swiping to just go to the
When
right
we work
info.
with our clients in this world, we've noticed that, kind of what some things that struck me, and then tell me if you're seeing the same pattern. So, like, one is the download fatigue in general. Like, so whether it's an app or like download this PDF, that PDF, this thing, they're like, so people do want the information, but they want easier access to the relevant information. And then I think and what we're seeing with AI that's been surprisingly relevant to us is they obviously don't want to ask ChatGPT questions about a drug, but if you could use the framework of ChatGPT, looking at the relevant materials that they feel are confident that this is precisely the material that I want aid with from AI tool, that there's a lot of interest in, right? So help me analyze of these five documentation assets about this particular area. This is my question. I don't want to go through five PDFs. I don't want to download an app. But I would ask questions. And as long as I know that the materials that it's looking at are related and I can trust, that shrinks this time. And then they will still go and check, right? Then they will still
Oh,
go
yeah,
and check, right? Like that
for
this is
sure.
actually answering. So what are you seeing kind of in the applications of AI? That the companies are starting to experiment with. It's been hard for the industry, just given, the approval cycles and length of everything to get done. But what have you been seeing that's innovative that's
Yeah.
happening there?
I mean, the problem with those new tools that doctors have access to also from their hospital or from their own pocket, in their phone, beyond the kind of okay sensitivity of the data, right? They are usually smart enough to not upload personal data and so on. The problem is the exhaustivity of the information. So basically, if you ask those, I would call it common LLM, and you ask them a question on what should I give as a dosage to my patient, and you want to have an accurate data, you want to have exhaustivity. You cannot just have a resume that is 80% correct. You need to have the 100% correct. So the
Right.
problem is legally, you can't rely on an information that is 100% correct, that is not 100% correct.
Then 100%. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you'll have to. So I'll give you an example of the best case that might happen in a few years. If the hospital impose a protocol on how to treat patients for a certain therapeutic area like cardiovascular, and the hospital decided that you need to do X, Y, and Z in that order to maximize cost efficiency, and they use a bot to assist the nurse, to assist the doctor, your doctor will still be able to override the
Yeah.
decision. But we know, you and I, that in a few years, for legal reason, the doctor will say, "Hey, I followed the protocol that was recommended to me, right? And I agreed with the protocol." So his responsibility is shifting from his medical practice license slowly to the hospital, to the system, right? And right now it's not the case. Right now the doctor can decide whatever he wants. Like if he says,
Yeah,
"I'll
the doctor is the one buying the liability insurance
exactly, the doctor is liable." But tomorrow, and I'm not saying this generation or the next generation of doctor, what happens in 40 years, right? In 40 years, you will have an AI that is basically talking with all the AI of the industry, trying to figure the next best protocol for that particular patient. And maybe your mobile phone has given data on the fly, on your weight, your mood, whatever. So you will have those assistants that are basically working in the background. So I would say the practice right now is very much aware that there is risk associated with decisions that are founded on data that is not 100% reliable. So there are startups that I know that are basically doing a better job at stabilizing the output of an information. Like I know a company in Chicago that is basically taking all PubMed data, and they compare it, they analyze it so that you don't have to read it. And if you ask the LLM they have on, "Okay, give me the list, like the exhaustive list of everyone who published on this matter," it will give it to you because it's trained to be exhaustive. But it will not give you an information that is such like, "Okay, treat your patient with this dosage because it will be better."
Exactly. This is what we're seeing. So it's funny, in other parts of the world that are also regulated, like in insurance, we're like, there's one strain of thought is like, well, if you're selecting your health and benefits insurance, we will recommend it to you. And so you could make some recommendations. I'm this, I'm that, on that basis, here's the recommendation. But for some people, that they don't want to go there, because that immediately, the moment you go from here's the information, here's kind of convenient way to consume information, and then here's what we recommend for you. The moment you start recommending, the employer could be liable, the benefits advisor could be liable because, hey, you recommended I do this and I did this and I didn't get coverage and all these bad things happen. And so that there's still that risk in the regulated world. So it feels like packaging the information to help people make decisions is much safer starting point than actually being the decider, so to speak. I think one of the kind of striking patterns that I've noticed, also that worries me, and I'm kind of curious about your take on broadly behavioral science and neuroscience that you're seeing happening in this world, is little things like Google Maps, right? You brought up a trip in Italy, and when you drive in the city that you know, so for me, for example, I know Paris, and I drive in Paris sometimes, and I see Google Map is just recommending
insane directions. Like that don't make any sense that make me drive extra 10 minutes. And I think there was a part of me at first that was like, well, I'm just gonna follow Google Map. And then you look back and you're like, this is really insane. This is, I don't know, is the map like trying to avoid traffic congestion and driving people this way? Did they lose their marbles and something? And so that mode is worrying me because like the like increasingly we're delegating our decision making to some tools and they're not good, right? Like the experts know that the tools are not good. So I'm curious if you started seeing this happen in the industry, and this kind of a goes broader to behavioral and neuroscience, right? Like how do we process information in this age of overload and not being an expert at everything?
So I've seen some work where surprisingly, again, when the data is generated by a machine, but it is useful, like Google is doing it right on the search. People are basically complaining that Google is stealing information from your website to give the answer to the user, and the user doesn't visit your website anymore. Right? So that's an issue, right? So basically, what will happen to your website tomorrow? You're just working for Google to basically have more visits. So you're basically investing SEO literally just to be on a
To support
directory.
Google's answers, yeah.
It's like a directory. Like you're not going to your website is not going to be better than,
Yeah.
Trust radius, whatever. Like you're just going to, and that's an issue, right? Because then sovereignty of your presence, it's going to create microcosm of information, and people will basically be of one passport. I'm tribe Google, I'm tribe Samsung, I'm tribe. You know what I mean? So it's going to create like different pockets of users, and it's okay. I mean, that's already happening. When people talked about the accuracy of the information or the dangerosity of the information, I'll tell them, look, it's like you're telling me there is a white web and the dark web, right? In terms of the information, you're not going to the dark web, right? Because people tells you it's bad and you can get nasty stuff. Tomorrow you will have less of that black and white. It's going to be gray. People will tell you, oh yeah, don't go to that Wikipedia platform because the information is not relevant. Go to this because it's the German government who did it, and like you're going to have n new forms of internet, I will say, that are going to be much more controlled, much more secured also. That's also the trade-off. When you want security, safety, you're going to lose a bit of the freedom. And in that world, in that context, the information that is controlled and made by a machine, and this is answering your simple need, then it's going, people are going to say, it's okay, I don't need more. Again, the only problem I see when it comes to content is when you want to be entertained. And the problem I've seen in the last 5 to 10 years, we went from basically mainstream, like TV type of content, where you can sit and focus 30 minutes to 1 hour in a show.
On a sitcom, still in a sitcom, right? But at
Yes.
least you can focus.
Correct. Yes. You can focus. And right now, basically, people are watching a TV show without really focusing on the TV show because they chat in real time. That's a thing. I mean, this, believe me or not, but people are watching everything by talking with others. So you're watching your Netflix movie, but you're watching it not with a full concentration like you have in a movie theater. You're watching it with like peers that are basically telling you, oh, have you seen this? What do you think? Blah, 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 right? So, and on the other side, you will see people who are lovers of long form content, like the Joe Rogan Experience podcast, when he sits 3 hours with someone and people literally listen to that. Like for 3 hours, they're basically amazed by the discovery. So I think there is like really like a
Bifurcation,
bigger.
yeah. So
Yes.
actually, that let's talk about that because it's a bizarro world a little bit. And I would say on the short, on the What worries me on the 30-minute format is I also see behavioral patterns of kids, right? And they're like looking, they're not even looking at the 30 minutes. I wish they were looking at 30 minutes. They're looking at TikTok, short reels, and you're just kind of completely glazing through that. And that is even more, more kind of hitting you like a slot machine for your attention. That, and so that same person needs to go and like, will that person be able to spend 3 hours listening to even Joe Rogan with all the interest, right? Or they're already too spoiled, right? Or will they be able to go concentrate and read the
Well,
100-page
you said
research
this
report?
yourself. Yeah, you said this yourself. I mean, Joe Rogan as a business, he's obliged to cut his 3 hours in millions of tiny 1 minute videos to attract the next generation because they want to have the sentence that is making you like go, wow, he said that, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think that's what we are looking at. You have a content that is hyper contextualized, needs to be distributed smartly. You need content that is highly shocking or entertaining or
And but you're thinking that that's a way to lead you in, or that's a way to not just lead you, like that's all we're gonna be. All we're gonna do is like a bunch of headlines and like very little substance. And then like the
No.
broader question is what that means for regulated and complex communications, where we're moving to that world. Or like one of the thoughts that we have is like, okay, how do I take that like back to Joe Rogan, right? Like how do we take a like this podcast episode, right, for example, and organize it into 21-minute videos that are kind of topically oriented, but they could work as a standalone, but they also work in the narrative. And then we create a format that creates a narrative around that. And so if you are like into it, you could jump around, right? And if you're not into it, you still have a little bit more than just, oh, this conversation and then the next conversation about, summer vacation in Italy in a Volvo, right? Like, which is, right? And they're completely random, you distracted and don't help you to stay focused and really absorb something, or we could organize information in a way that moves you further towards a goal.
So that's more operational for me. So this is what I call this a content vortex, right? The content vortex is the strategy where you say to yourself, okay, I'm going to do one book. I give you an example. And some pharma company, I think Merck is doing this. Some pharma company does that. So they say, okay, let's build a book that we do 2025 edition. And the book is going to be 250 page. And the book is a like scientific memory of how we see the world, right? It's like basically our statement to the world. There is a new editor every year, like it's a book. That book then creates white papers. Like you extract things from that book. And every month, or every 2 weeks, if you want, you have a new white paper that is beautifully crafted. It feels new, but it's just basically bouncing
Repurposing of
on.
that book.
Yeah, it's bouncing on the chapter of one of the chapters of the book, right? And then from that book, you extract, like big ideas, and you create blog articles, 2,000 words, 2,000 to 4,000 words, whatever. Long form blog articles with at least, three paragraph, three arguments, right? And then basically from that blog post, you create, your short form content. You create, and from one of the big ID, you extract a quote, you extract a carousel, blah, blah, blah. So that is what I've seen built by content factories in terms of disseminating the content in multi-channel and basically having the best bang for your buck. Like you
Because
really
you're basically,
invest.
you have the book, but then you can break it down into multiple form factors.
And
And so,
I say book just to give, because some people will see books like the like super complex things to do. I'll give another example. Like you have a yearly symposium, like
yes.
there's the big events. You're investing lots of money on your events, and this events can basically create a report, a yearly report, right?
Yeah.
And you've seen companies, and I don't know if you're watching, but there are a lot of companies telling you this is our 2025 report on ESG, blah, 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 right? They basically are doing more than just an ESG report. They're telling the way they see the world through the ESG lens, right? It's a lot of content. And then that content is disseminated inside an editorial line called ESG.
Well, it's fascinating that you bring this up. So we see this concept work in some areas, but in a lot of places it just stops at that report, right? It's like, oh my God, this work, we worked so hard on this report. It took so much work to put together this thing. We're just gonna, and it's like, I'm gonna it, like say it like for ESG, but it could be like a company annual report, right? Like a or the flagship, the brand's flagship thing that's kind of defines what it is, right? Their industry trends. And it's typically they slap the CEO name on that. They may even interview them for 5 minutes. And the so they are so they work so hard on getting that thing done. Then in the last mile, they're like, here's the PDF. We slap it on our website. We get a banner to promote it and we're done. And I feel like this is like 80% to 90% of these corporate communications and there. And then there is no content factory efforts to do this, like to bring it down, to atomize it, to humanize it. And it feels like a huge loss, frankly, right? Because who is gonna, are your employees gonna look at that? Are your stakeholders gonna go and realistically, in this day and age, read through 200 pages, small font? Or, can you get them to find the chapters they care about and so on and then engage?
So
So what's your advice
yeah.
there? Like, how do you
So
help people?
it's I'm coming back to the word culture, right? It's basically if you set as a business rule in your company that everyone is incentivized to become the next whatever title by checking the box and just showcasing that you deliver, right? There is kind of the word leadership is dictated by internal scorecards or OKRs, right? And in the problem for me, it starts there. It starts at the definition of what good looks like on the outside. What is the and it's not necessarily sometimes sales. That's why sales and it's a consequence, right? This is what we want to achieve, right? You want to find the nerves that goes into that. But we know also that brands that are doing a good job are nurturing sales because of the investment, the equity they possess, right? And the leaders that understood this, they say, my brand is everything because it's what is going to leave. It's the legacy of the founding team. It's what we created that is going to leave, without it's basically the noise that you hear about the brand when you're not in the room, right? So and the brands that are doing a good job at creating that delightful experience and doing the good job at operationalizing content, for example, for sustaining the brand essence and the brand tonality, are also rooted in the why we do this. Why are we spending this extra time to do this
So we're not
pixel
doing this
perfect?
report to say, hey, here's the ESG checklist or here's the annual report
No,
checklist. It's
you
like
want
we
a
want to
report.
activate our shareholders. We want to activate our stakeholders. We want everybody to, who
And
cares
people,
about us.
I worked with corporate communication teams that are basically, when they write something, they're basically saying, I want to make sure that the financial observer that is going potentially to write a paper about our company, I want him to really, really understand what is it to live and work for this company? What is our purpose? And you don't have an interview, you don't have time to do 20 emails. To the vehicle for changing the behavior of that guy who is basically having 20 companies that he has 20 top Fortune 500 companies to pick for writing a paper. And he works at Forbes or Financial Times or whatever you name it, and he needs to pick one. I can guarantee you, if there is some effort done in that that report, they will say, yeah, you know what,
They
there is
care. There's something there. It's easier for me. And they care, right? Is
there is
that,
an experience.
yeah.
I guarantee you, open a white paper from Apple. Open a white paper from Apple, just the stupidest white paper that you can find, like the when they explain how they recycle their plugs, you know, something so stupid that, as this. You see the craft the way they write and it's just, you know, I'm not saying you will read it per se, but if you're basically a student and you want to find like a paper where you can base yourself as a reference, man, it's easy to read, it's easy to find. So at every corner, every touch point of the brand, there is care, there is a delightful experience. And I think this is what you don't find in the pharma industry, for example. It's basically, yeah, we have to, the law is asking me to do this. Let's do what the law is asking me to do.
And so those that will bring that will have basically an edge, and they will feel better about, you know, because the irony is that the pharma companies are actually, you know, the when you work there, when you support clients in pharma, you feel really proud about what you're doing because you're actually really impacting lives in a positive way. But it's this sort of reminds me of the saying, it's not about what people, you know, whether people think you're really smart or they, you know, that you make them feel that you're an activist, but it's like generally like what do they feel after they talk to you as a human being? Do they feel, do how do they feel? Do they feel energized? Do they feel empowered? Do they feel excited about whatever you're excited about? Are you able to transfer energy in a memorable way at the interaction? And so
I'll give an example on this, you know, to get to that level of sentiment, you know, and that je ne sais quoi, right? That you're in the room and you don't know what's happening. I'll imagine that your brand is a president of the United States and you're running for a campaign and people have to vote for you. What will you do to move the people hearts and mind for your brand? To ask them to pay with a credit card or to prescribe your drug. So it's beyond just the facts and figures. So yes, it matters, right? If there is someone else that basically is saying, this team has done so much of a great job in their clinical trial. They are the first line of therapy because their science is 10 times better. Of course, you don't have to work much. You see? So if your product is 10 times better scientifically, everyone is going to prescribe it, right? It's a no-brainer. But on top of this, right, if you're saying that, yeah, but on top of having the best scientific drugs, their training to pharmacists is spot on. When there is a problem with a product, their pharmacovigilance is spot on. It's a delight to basically work with their I don't know, like scientific teams if we have a question.
Questions.
So if there is anything beyond the product, there your company becomes a product. That's what I'm trying to say. Your company, your brand is also a product. And the content is basically part of it, right? So it's one touch point, it's one vehicle to get through the eye. And also remember, right, we are right now talking about human beings. And the humans have a limit in terms of content consumption. I was talking about the showstopper and the amount of the magma of content we have. So this is humans have a cap of bandwidth of content they can consume and be delighted with per day, right? That's the issue. And you talk about frequency and reach. This is where creativity plays a role, right? To how to basically play the game to catch the heart, and then you bring the science and the contextual info. But why I'm saying this, because the real game tomorrow is going to convince platforms that you have the best content and services. So that also is right now the most demand I see is how do I convince a ChatGPT like that my product needs to be the answer for ChatGPT?
Right.
That's a different question. So I have actually been very vocal on this almost 10 years ago when Alexa started to come into houses. And people were asking me, yeah, but we don't need to focus on that because it's just like a home device telling you the weather. Why should we bother with, from a farmer angle, right? And I said, look, if you're a mom and you're using Alexa for everything and it's convenient and she uses it for Wikipedia, and Alexa start to choose what to give her. Not, she's not going to Google anymore. Alexa is the filter. What
So
happens?
Perplexity is the new Alexa, or ChatGPT is
Exactly.
the new Alexa.
Exactly.
All
Exactly.
right.
So, and then now pharma companies are saying, hey, but how can I influence the algorithm so that my product is the first line?
Got it. Well, this is a great way to wrap up. So I think it's part of it is like you're still, whether you're regulated or not, you're competing for informational space. And then so one is just to get in there, and then the second is once you're in there, how do you ultimately stand out and carry the brand voice in a way that's authentic, and it'll give you the permission to say, hey, we are 10x better, or we're like discovered the science, right? Like you can't, the science itself does not lead to the success anymore in this kind of world where you're competing in a very dense informational space. And I think
Right.
that is something that historically the regulated industries, because they thought, well, if we just share enough information and we say that we've been around for 100 years, that's good enough, right? And I think that's no longer the case.
No, it's
Well, listen, Haider, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing
sure.
your insights with our audience. How can people find you and continue to learn more about
I
what you're
mean, yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, so I'm pretty vocal on those topics on there. So yeah, they can just search and
doing? All right.
find me.
We'll do that.
Or ask a
Thanks. Ask
ChatGPT.
ChatGPT, right? So again, Haider, the thought leader on how brands could navigate in regulated industries through
Yeah.
content and much more. Thank you
Thanks.
so much, Haider, for your insights.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relayto.com, RELYTO.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relayto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.